All right, thank you. So, well, the charge from management you just heard, which is to kind of explain what the program is about to the rest of the people. And wave-flow interaction is an ancient subject. I mean, Leonardo wrote about it and drew pictures of it and has, of course, was a focus of fascination for mathematicians and physicists through the 18th and 19th and 20th century. It's a broad subject, but a large part of what our program is dealing with is sort of one corner of it, which is the problem of waves and zonal flows, right? And I think you all are surely familiar with the idea of zonal flows. If you think, say, of one of the nice things about blackboard lunches is you don't have to deal with amassing color pictures, but things like the belts of Jupiter and the jet stream and so forth, basically azimuthally symmetric zones that emerge in very highly turbulent atmospheres. And you see right away it's going to be a problem essentially of pattern formation in a quasi two-dimensional fluid. Now, what you may not be so familiar with is that these types of things also play a critical role in magnetic fusion and plasma confinement. And I mean, here is a very poor sketch of a tokamak, you know, a toroidal confinement device with a strong magnetic field, say, in the axial direction there. Of course, implicit here is the plasma is rotating. And the critical element is rotation or the cyclotron frequency. And what emerges is that you find that there are kind of zonal E cross B flows that emerge in the poloidal cross section. And these things have very similar physics foundations and physical properties, and the similar ideas are used. So we've spent a lot of time on kind of talking about similarities and differences of these. I would point out, though, that the zonal flows in confined plasmas are not a subject of, shall we say, purely scientific curiosity, in that they are essential for the confinement process. I mean, in other words, the system, for various reasons, might tend to develop eddies that would span the cross-section, and that would be very bad for confinement. It would basically transport heat and particles out. And basically what happens is the zonal flows tend to break up these eddies and restrict the radial mixing length of the in the plasma. And the result of that, in some sense, is the justification for the construction of ether. So in some sense, wave-flow interaction is involved in the fundamental ideas of a $20 billion project. So what I'm going to do is spend about, say, 30 minutes or so on some basic ideas, and this will, of course, put the people in our program a bit to sleep, and then 30 minutes on what I might call hot topics. In other words, more forefront, talking a bit about more forefront things that we've been talking about. So again, going back to the charge, what is the topic about? In this topic, and certainly these problems of pattern formation in geophysical and plasma flows and rotating flows is really an exercise in two things, I would say, freezing in laws. And Kelvin's theorem. And these two things effectively meet at the subject of potential vorticity, which I will define, and its uses. Now, on freezing in-laws, right, I think you all know something about that. If you imagine you have a flow, and you have a line, you have 2 points in the flow, say 1 and 2, and a line segment between them, then the length of this line segment evolves, of course, according to dl dt is equal to grad v dot l. Grad l dot grad v. And the idea, of course, is that, there's no grad here, sorry. Not awake yet. Only 2 cups of coffee this morning. It'll get better. So the idea, of course, is where the flow goes, it takes the line segment with it. And I think you immediately see that, for example, in standard Navier-Stokes with P of P of rho, and I'll assume that throughout this for simplicity, omega over rho is frozen in, omega being curl of V, the vorticity, and the magnetic field over rho is also frozen in. So it's a kind of familiar concept, and it means a certain memory. Now, if you introduce rotation, of course, the equation of motion acquires a Coriolis force. You can stick any centrifugal force into the pressure. And the upshot of that is that now the local vorticity, but twice the rotation frequency over rho is frozen in. So we have a relationship where d by dt of omega plus twice the rotation frequency over the density is equal to omega plus twice the over the density dot grad v, and this becomes then the freezing in relationship for the total vorticity. This being the local fluid vorticity, and this being the planetary vorticity. Now we can construct a conserved quantity from that by the observation that if we have some scalar, which we'll call psi, that is frozen into the flow, we would have d psi dt is equal to 0. And if we look at the difference between psi at one point and psi at the other, right, and we'll call this difference delta psi, then automatically this difference will be frozen in, will be conserved along trajectories, I should say. But we can write this difference delta psi as grad psi dot dl, right, when you stop to think about it. So, you know, you see that here dl, our friend the line segment, obeys this kind of basic equation here, and which is fundamentally the same equation as the total vorticity freezing in law. So we can immediately then write a kind of conservation relation for the quantity omega plus 2 big omega over rho dot grad psi. Right, and this thing is a very fundamental idea, this which is pervasive in this business, and this is basically the conservation of potential vorticity. Right? And in a very real sense, a large part of the program is about PV conservation and its consequences. And I should add, by the way, that this relationship ultimately emerges from the kind of usual kind of vorticity equation. Right, and the upshot of this is you also have a Kelvin's theorem for the total vorticity, which I think everyone knows how to prove. Right. And the physical idea of a lot of the games in geophysical and plasma fluids is, in some sense, to understand what's going on when you move a chunk of fluid in a system with inhomogeneity. So maybe I should rewrite the basic PV conservation equation now in maybe just a little bit more telling form. So I will allow for an inhomogeneity in the rotation frequency, an inhomogeneity in the density, right? And the idea then becomes a game of trade-offs, okay? So if I move a chunk of fluid around in a system where there's an inhomogeneity in the rotation frequency or a density, there must be an adjustment in the local vorticity to take up the change to conserve the total PV. And that then is kind of the governing idea in a lot of what's going on. Now, that's one of the, I should say, of course, where there is a conserved quantity, there's a symmetry, and the underlying symmetry here is what's called particle relabeling symmetry. In other words, you can relabel the particles without changing the thermodynamic state of the system. But we will kind of won't get into that at great lengths here. The other thing I should say is, of course, this quantity, potential vorticity, is often written as Q, and that is a very good choice of notation, the double entendre for charge in the plasma application. So then the question with this general idea, what do we do then to say something a bit more substantive? Well, there's of course, you can spend the whole textbook going around and deriving various limits for geophysical flow equations, but I think we'll confine ourselves here to the simplest, which is what's called the beta plane model. And the idea is very simple. If you imagine you had an atmosphere, a planet or something, and you imagine you have a plane tangent to the atmosphere, and you consider, motion in this plane, and so you would kind of consider displacing, say, a fluid element from one point to the other. Here it's actually simpler to go directly from Kelvin's theorem, and Kelvin's theorem would basically say that the time derivative of, say, the area of the element, assuming this thing is rotating about the axis, plus times omega plus 2 omega sine theta, and of course, annoyingly, theta is measured from the equator. This whole thing doesn't change. So if you imagine displacing a fluid element from here to here, you would get then the fact that the vorticity would have to change according to minus 2 omega cosine theta d theta dt. And you can rewrite this thing as minus beta vy. And I should say that the coordinates in this game, and it's going to annoy you because the coordinates in the plasma game are different, are y for changes in latitude and x for changes in longitude, okay? Now, the only thing that remains is, what's the meaning of all this? Well, if you go back to the basic equation, rho dv dt is equal to minus grad p plus 2 omega cross v. The point, of course, is you're playing a game where the fastest frequency in the problem is the rotation frequency. So the dominant balance is between these two goodies. The velocity, then, is what's called the geostrophic velocity. Grad p, and z is out of the plane over 2 omega. And the vorticity then is nothing more than del squared p over 2 omega. And this thing then becomes, you know, in simple terms, right, we have the beta plane equation, which let me just call it like this. P is equivalent to the stream function in this problem. And this is probably the simplest representation of dynamics in these, you know, low frequency, low Rossby number, large scale dynamics in these systems. Now you say you mentioned plasmas.
Yeah, you mentioned Rossby number.
Yeah.
Can you remind everybody, I always get it backwards.
Rossby number is simply the ratio of the relevant time scale of the fluid. So it would be V over L to the rotation frequency. I probably should have defined that sooner. So we're talking at the high rotation frequencies or necessarily large scales to drive this below one. And it is, of course, the fact that the Rossby number is low that allows the game of geostrophic balance to compute the balance of the velocities there. Now I promised plasmas. Now one of the interesting thing is that you can use the same tricks to immediately get to one. Plasmas have an infinity of models. I should say even the people in our program have been complaining about the complexity of plasma models, and they haven't really seen anything yet. Or have I erased it? Where is my friend PV? So let's go to my friend PV here. So I'm going to call this Q. Right, is equal to omega plus 2 omega dot grad psi over rho. Now it is, having done this simple exercise for GFD, and one can basically read off the answer. So we simply take the twice the rotation frequency goes to the ion cyclotron frequency. Okay, so in some sense, the critical element of the fast frequency is now supplied by the magnetic field setting up the cyclotron frequency as the highest frequency. We'll not worry about the mass factor, but we will allow density fluctuations. So I'll put this as n naught plus n tilde. And I'll make life easy by writing grad psi is equal to z hat. Okay, and when we do that, and I'm envisioning now a kind of situation, just to be clear, where we have a strong magnetic field and some kind of profile, right, peaked on axis and dropping off toward the edges. And when you do that, basically what you get is d by dt of the z component, again, z is out of the xy plane vorticity, plus omega I over n naught of r plus n tilde. Right, and you immediately then have a very useful expression for conserved PV for the plasma, and you can expand for small density fluctuations, and you get to d by dt of omega z.
Sorry, could you remind us of the coordinate system now?
The coordinate system here is x or r is in the radial direction. Y or theta, which I use interchangeably, or is in the poloidal direction, and Z is in the direction of the axial magnetic field. So we're setting up the flow in basically this poloidal plane here. Okay.
What is omega I?
Omega I is the cyclotron frequency, you know, the Larmor frequency. So maybe, you know, QB over MC. And I'm talking about an ion fluid here. One thing probably most of you haven't gotten into the fun of two fluids. Probably most of your experience is probably in MHD. The relevant fluctuations for describing confinement require separate treatment of the electrons and ions, okay? So we're talking really, for the moment, about the ion fluid. And we'll take care of the electrons momentarily and use the fact that the scales of the fluctuations are large compared to the bilength, so we can impose what's called quasi-neutrality, in other words, equality of ion and electron fluctuation levels. Okay? Any more here? And by the way, there is a reversal of notation relative to our GFD friends, who use, in a sense, y for the non-trivial coordinate and x for the symmetric coordinate. And I've lived with that for, you know, getting on 35 years, so you just have to live with it. There's never been a Geneva Convention to change it. Okay, so moving along, here we have a statement of conserved PV here. You notice, basically, we can write this then as minus omega I 1 over n naught dn I dt equals 0.
Pat, I think Toby had a question.
Yeah, all right.
Oh, thank you. Yes, thank you. Yeah, since you mentioned MHD, as far as I know, there's no generalization of potential plasticity to MHD.
We'll come back to that at the end. What happens is the Lorentz force breaks conservation of potential vorticity.
Right, and so but here there is conservation. So,
because we're considering electrostatic fluctuations.
Oh, I see.
Okay?
Oh, okay.
Which, I mean, as that's another topic we can get into perhaps a bit later. Going to the Ohm's law, the usual balance in MHD is the balance between the inductive electric field and the electrostatic field. In things like drift waves, which are the counterpart of Rossby waves that we're about to encounter, the relevant balance that you bring the pressure, and the relevant pressure balance is between the pressure gradient and the electrostatic field, and the inductive field is weak, and only until you get to high beta in the plasma sense of high thermal to magnetic pressure. That's another notational disaster that you have to live with. Okay. All right. So you notice this thing effectively says so. That, you know, PV here is equal to omega z minus omega I n I over some normalization. Well, you can go a little further, and again, you have rho dvi dt, and now, of course, you have the electrostatic field, so you have the gradient of the potential. In the simple problems, you don't have to worry so much about the pressure, but you do have the Lorentz force. So the analog of the geostrophic balance is the balance between the electric field and V cross B, and that then gives us, that's sort of the counterpart of the geostrophic balance, and it gives us the velocity is C over B grad phi cross Z. And likewise, omega z then becomes, in the properly normalized variables, rho s squared del squared phi, where rho s squared is essentially the ion gyro radius. Now, the last remaining thing is, of course, to realize that you have quasi-neutrality. In other words, the scales are large compared to the bilength. And so you have the balance of the two species. And the other thing to realize is the electrons here are very fast relative to the ions. So basically, over the scales of interest, the parallel phase velocity, in other words, the phase velocity of particles of waves along the magnetic field sits in between the electron thermal speed and the ion thermal speed, which means to good approximation you can take the electrons as Boltzmann in lowest order. Right? So what that does then is it closes this basic equation, and you have a kind of very famous equation in plasma physics called the Hasegawa-Mina equation, which is kind of the lowest, simplest description of drift waves, which and is kind of what I would call drift Rossby wave turbulence with zonal flow. So let me just write out times a wasting. So, you know, you'll note kind of the close similarity of the problems. That, you know, here we have the beta plane equation. Right, and here we have the Hasegawa-Mina equation. So let me just write this as
Pat, what was beta? Was that the coordinate of the planes?
Let me finish that for a second, and then we will deal with this. Let me finish this, and I will deal with that. There's no shortage of notation in this business, I will admit. All right, beta is the gradient in the Coriolis force. So if my memory serves me correctly, it's 2 omega cosine theta. Theta was the angle you were putting the plane at over the radius. Okay? So the relationships start to get interesting, right? The density gradient in the plasma is the analog of the gradient of the Coriolis force, and plays as the relevant inhomogeneity that makes the dynamics interesting. You'll notice there are a zillion different versions of both models, but I claim this is the fundamentally fair comparison because it is the comparison of one quasi-two-dimensional simplest possible model with another. You notice that this goodie, which comes from the electrons, has no counterpart in the ion equation. Okay, in the beta plane equation. So there is a fundamental difference in the two systems as well. You notice too that, I mean, the appeal to two-dimensionality here is based, say, on a thin layer and strong stratification. The appeal to two-dimensionality here is a result basically of the fact that the electrons are extremely fast relative to the ions in their motion along the magnetic field, so they can basically average over the direction and Boltzmannize. And that's how the structure comes out. Both these equations, you know, have kind of two basic properties that immediately stare you in the face, and I would say are ubiquitous in this subject. By the way, both are statements of conservation of PV, right? PV in the case of the beta plane is just del squared P or phi plus beta y, and PV in the plasma is just phi minus rho s squared del squared phi plus essentially log of n naught of r over some normalization n bar, whatever. And you'll note, too, that what I said before, this is essentially charge. In other words, this is the sum of a total charge minus rho s squared del squared phi. So this density is really the electrons, okay? And that's basically, you can think of that as the guiding center charge, and this goodie as the polarization charge that is carried by the ions, and it's due to their larger inertia. They move off the magnetic field line. So we have a kind of one-size-fits-all picture. It's very interesting. Of course, there are important differences, particularly as we'll see in the dispersion. Now, if you look at the models, what stares you in the face is both are essentially 2D fluids. In other words, the nonlinearities are related to advection of vorticity. Both support waves, right? And the waves are a consequence of these trade-offs from displacement of a total PV, and the trade-off between the variation of the mean part and the variation of the fluid vorticity. And these waves are called, in the case of the fluid, the Rossby wave, with the frequency minus beta kx over k squared. And in the case of the plasma, the drift wave, which is ky or k theta v star over 1 plus k perp squared rho s squared. And rho s, again, is the gyro frequency, gyro radius. V star is what we call the diamagnetic velocity, and you can kind of think of this as rho s over the density gradient scale length times the speed of sound. The other thing that stares you in the face, of course, in the event that the perturbations are symmetric, you get a zero frequency mode, which is a vortex mode, and that's the zonal flow. And you can kind of see that from the get-go, of course, that again, going back to the basic cartoon, if we have an element here, you know, of course, I've been talking about displacements this way, but I could just as easily talk about displacements that way, which if I had homogeneity in longitude, would change nothing, which would be a symmetry of the system, and then bingo, I would have a zero frequency mode. So, hence the basic story of the contents of the model. Now to more interesting things. The problem that one confronts here is, and how are we doing here? We're not doing so well on, not so bad, is, you know, what you know, how to say in 25 words or less the character of the problem. And the problem really is one of wave and eddy turbulence. Right. So probably you all know about two-dimensional fluids, and the point of turbulence in two-dimensional fluids is, of course, you have two quadratically conserved quantities, entropy and energy. So you might want to say, how do I arrange for two similarity ranges to carry them? And the answer is you can't. And unless they carry them separately. So the upshot of that is a picture that if you force at some scale here, that you will have a forward cascade of entropy, which has a kind of k to the minus 3 spectrum, and an inverse cascade of energy, which has a k to the minus 5/3 spectrum. And the other thing that, you know, strikes you immediately is that the importance of waves and eddies may sit in different parts of the spectrum. So, I mean, if you look at, say, the real frequency of the wave, of course, it's going to be large, that long wavelength, due to the strong dispersion. If I look, say, at the turnover rate or correlation time of the eddy, it's going to be something like kv tilde k, where this is going to be bigger on small scale. So you have a picture in your mind then that there will be kind of a transition somewhere down here if you imagine forcing at very small scales to something of a wave range, right? And there will be a crossover scale, okay? And this crossover scale is of kind of great characteristic importance in this business. And it has a name, the Rhine scale. And it basically is the it is the transition between where the three-wave mismatch crosses the kind of the eddy turnover rate. And to make a long story short, this scale I'll call LR is defined as VRMS, square root of VRMS over beta. I think a more accurate kind of way of thinking about it was the way it was formulated by Vallis and Maltrude. Rather than treating this as a VRMS, it was effectively to match this to the rate of transfer of the inverse cascade, and in which case, so I'll call this Rhines, Vallis, Maltrude, goes as epsilon to the 1/5, beta to the 3/5 downstairs. And say our star-forming friends may find it useful to think of this as the scale of critical balance, right? It is the scale where the linear frequencies and the nonlinear frequencies effectively match. It does not have the same significance, say, as critical balance in the Goldreich-Schwedar theory, because it is a particular scale rather than a range of scales.
So what is your epsilon?
What? Epsilon is the, if I'm going to define the rate of, it's the energy dissipation rate for the inverse cascade. Okay? Now, you might say, well, this is all very nice, but what happened to the zonal flow in this story? And the zonal flow is about to reassert itself. So, one of the most basic questions you could ask is, how is the zonal flow formed? And it's, I think, very reasonable to think that the zonal flow would emerge as a result of some kind of inverse cascade process. So you might ask, well, could we say a little more about that? Well, when we get into the inverse cascade range here, and we enter the wave range, wave turbulence is very different from what I would call eddy turbulence. I mean, it has in property, in the basic idea, the properties that it's carrying a finite flux of energy. But basically, you describe what's going on in wave turbulence by a game of say, the master equation, computing the transfer rates from the, say, the Fermi-Golden rule. So the critical element, then, is satisfying, say, three-wave resonances, right? Something like this. And the problem you can see is if you've got a highly dispersive wave, this becomes very tough to do. In other words, it's extremely difficult to satisfy the three-wave resonances for Rossby waves due to their strong dispersion at long wavelengths. So the game, of course, is to make life easy and say, if I have one of these guys and I put, say, kx prime equals zero, so rather than having three waves, I have two waves and a zonal flow, and I exploit in the presence of the zonal mode, it becomes very easy to satisfy the matching condition. The upshot of that is that the scale of the zonal flow then naturally emerges at this scale, the Rhine scale. And in some sense, the zonal flow is kind of a natural player in carrying the inverse cascade started in the eddy range to large scales beyond the Rhine scale. It's effectively required to carry the flux of energy, okay? And if you might ask, why isn't there a range of zonal scales? The answer is the coupling coefficient drops as you go to the large scale, so it favors actually the Rhine scales. And it's a very useful concept at a crude level. People have done things like try to count the number of bands in Jupiter by taking the diameter of the planet and seeing how many Rhine scales you can fit in, and it sort of works crudely, et cetera. Now, the problem with this is it is a story and little more. And zonal modes, historically, this was for a long time was regarded as the explanation of zonal modes, but historically, zonal modes are much more clever than the people trying to study them, okay? And, the Rhine's story is useful as a first introduction, but zonal flows pop up all over the place in systems that don't have such a nice, convenient separation of scales that you can use familiar concepts and so forth. So I'll talk a little bit about sort of other approaches. So this is, in some sense, the first one is what I would call the inverse cascade approach, and I might add, this is a local. You notice we were basically forming the zonal modes by the kind of standard local inverse cascade. Well, there's a kind of very simple way of seeing it, and it kind of appears. And it's relevant in both plasmas, confined plasmas, and in geophysical fluids, which is the by what kind of a quasi-linear picture from wave radiation. And the idea is exceedingly simple. You could imagine, here's something, and you could imagine you are forcing by whatever means, weather, storms, external excitation. And of course, the forcing will radiate Rossby waves, okay, going off like this. And, this becomes like an E&M problem, and the energy will go off in, say, the y direction or the latitudinal direction at the group velocity, and the group velocity for the Rossby wave is 2 beta kx ky over k squared squared. And the other thing that you notice, a kind of basic thing, is if you compute the Reynolds stresses, say the transport of momentum, again at the level of a kind of quasi-linear theory, you would have a sum on modes of minus kx, ky by k squared. And the thing that strikes you is these two guys have a common factor. But you will note a difference in sign. And this is revealing of a very general feature of these kinds of systems is that they tend to converge angular momentum on regions of wave excitation. Okay, so in other words, a nice quote from Isaac Held that I'm fond of, the central result that a rapidly rotating flow when stirred in a localized region will converge angular momentum into that region. So what that means is momentum is going to come in here. So, where is it going to come from? It's really clearly going to come from the surroundings. So what you're going to get for the flow pattern is something like this, right? And where, of course, you get a bigger bigger jet in one direction because you're converging from two others, and of course you have to conserve total momentum. And bingo, in a sense, this region of excitation breaks up into an array of jets. So that's an example of a mechanism that really works by linear properties of the waves alone and doesn't require any kind of games with inverse cascades and nonlinear transfers. And it kind of an interesting. So what is becoming increasingly a focus, a little bit in that spirit, is shall we say, something in between. Again, exploiting the fact that there is a disparity in frequencies and timescales between the waves and the zonal modes, but not such a convenient separation of scales. And the game is effectively one of modulational instability. And this has a long history. I was interested to see that the idea of modulational instabilities in turbulence, in other words, do a kind of vortical second sound mode appear in a system of turbulence, was actually considered by Lord Kelvin, interestingly enough, in 1887. And in the history of zonal flows, I think the first story with modulational instabilities goes back to Sinai and Michalkin, who were basically, if we have a kind of Hadley cells and then we consider modulating them, will these break up and then to form a zonal flow? And a natural way of approaching these is from what a kind of quasi-particle picture. So the idea is to treat the gas of waves from a kind of a quasi-particle gas, and in particular to exploit the disparity in timescales to define and use an adiabatic invariant, and that physicists love adiabatic invariants, and that adiabatic invariant is simply the wave action density, which you can also view in some sense as the density of quasi-particles. And then, of course, then to do mean field theory for the zonal flow, right? And so the game becomes effectively writing something like, a conservation. Let me just write this in simple terms, v dot grad n minus d by dx of omega plus k dot v dot dn dk. We were talking about this kind of thing during the conference. This is seemingly, it's a routine game in plasma physics, comes out of the subject of Langmuir turbulence, which is Thursday's tutorial. And you can allow then for growth of waves by instability mechanisms and kind of non-action conserving breaking. Okay, so the name of the game is essentially to solve this thing, kind of quasi-particle conservation equation, familiar, I think, to all, and then to use it to calculate modulations in the flow, right? And where. Right, so, and it's easy enough to relate the Reynolds stresses to the quasi-particle gas, and off you go. And this also has the attractive feature, you can start to describe the system in terms of kind of two populations. We might call the population of waves, it's like an ecology, the population of waves is the prey, right, because this effectively taps the free energy and feeds the zonal mode by the stresses. And the zonal mode is the predator because it basically lives off the prey by the action of the stresses and the shearing that it exerts. And it's become a very popular picture and receiving a lot of discussion. And that brings us then at this point maybe to the subject of hot topics, okay, because it's, I think, a good entry here. A very hot topic in our conference, picking up on this, is how good a representation of the dynamics is. So let me call this, is how good is the adiabatic approximation? All right, this is called the quasi-linear approximation by a circle of people I'm used to calling quasi-linear something else. But the question is really, how does this work? If this works, it's very attractive because it allows a kind of reduced model of the system, and you basically you get rid of the detailed dynamics. It also, by the way, the interactions here are highly non-local. This differs significantly from the picture of an inverse cascade. Although there is transfer from small to large scales, it is not in the sequence of steps. It is rather highly non-local. And this is certainly attractive in fusion modeling because of the fact that you can eliminate some of the messy details of the simulations. And then, of course, the next question is, of course, it doesn't really work, but how bad an approximation is it, and what do we need to fix it up? So there was a lot of discussion about various intermediate solutions. For example, do we just need a breaking model? In other words, do we need something here to model kind of local mixing to provide irreversibility in the response of the wave population? One can say, do we need to consider zonal modes plus other large eddies? Okay. And finally, do we have to just throw up our hands and do a full closure, which is, at that point, you kind of wonder, why not just do a DNS and be done with it, okay? The interesting thing that is emerging is that some intermediate solution seems to be working fairly well. In other words, the idea of using a breaking model and some simple kind of fix-up to model turbulent entrainment is enough of a band-aid, as it were, to patch up the adiabatic approximation. And if that can be developed and shown to stick, that will be, I think, a great service in modeling in both GFT and plasma applications. Now, a second problem, which is dear to my heart, is the problem of staircases. We're almost there. And there's been a lot of discussion in the program on staircases. And staircases basically is a way of describing a phenomenon of choppy profiles. In other words, where you might think you would have a smoothly varying profile, you would have something where it would be fairly flat, there would be a region of very sharp gradients, another flat spot, and another sharp gradient. We've talked about staircases in beta plane fluids. We've talked about staircases in thermohaline convection, which has nothing to do with shear flows in some sense, as far as I can see. And we've talked about staircases in plasmas. So I'll talk about that, since it's dearest to my heart. And this, two of our young program participants, Guillaume de Prevelier and Yusuke Kosuga, have made, I think, important contributions in this subject. The interesting thing is if you put a heat flux across a system of drift, really what we call ion temperature gradient turbulence, but for any practical purposes, you can think of it as these drift wave things. You would expect, therefore, you'd excite instabilities, you'd get turbulent mixing, there'd be some temperature gradient such that a thermal diffusivity would, at times grad T, would equal QI. Well, that's not what you get. What you, in fact, get, if I draw, is you get some quasi-periodic, as I call this, I'm drawing R over L sub T, where L sub T is the temperature gradient scale length. You get a staircase. In other words, you get a kind of a flattish profile of steps with big jumps in the temperature in between, kind of corrugations. With each of these steps, you get a shear layer. Okay, in other words, very interesting phenomena forms up there. The third thing that's, I think, and this the shear layer is basically supporting the steep temperature gradient. The third thing that is quite interesting, I haven't mentioned this, but there is another secondary structure that lives in these problems. You might think of it as an avalanche. It comes from the fact that the basic fluctuations are somewhat localized and they can overturn and produce a series of bursts relative to, and sort of much like an avalanche in a sand pile. And there's actually an amazing degree of similarity, okay? And the point is that the staircase step size turns out to set the outer scale of the avalanche distribution. So in some sense, there's a pattern competition going on in these problems between avalanching and the zonal flow formation. And the system solves the problem by kind of separating them into two different regions. And you know, the other thing is the transport in between the steps is not local. In other words, you do not have a situation where Q is equal to some turbulent diffusivity times grad T, but rather it is described by an integral kernel. You know, this thing has the form of a strength of r minus r prime squared plus delta squared. Okay, so where this delta is, of course, tied to the steps in between the between the shear layers. And this is a process of kind of a forming what amounts to a lattice of transport barriers. You know, the effect of transport in the steps becomes reduced and is a, you know, is of great interest because transport barriers are observed in systems, and the idea may be that the staircase collapses to form a single barrier is what's going on in the barrier formation. And
you mean a spatial lattice?
Yes, a spatial lattice. It kind of sits there, kind of quasi-stationary, drifting very slowly. It's quite amazing, and an interesting approach to this, which I don't have time to get in here to here, is that a kind of a model that seems to capture some of the basic properties from this comes out of traffic flow, basically from the idea of looking at what amounts to jamming waves in traffic flow. And I see our leader is about to, I'll be done in a second. And the interesting thing is that these traffic flow models kind of tend to form very slowly moving trains of solitons, or solitary waves, where the peaked waves are effectively traffic jams. And a critical element in forming the jam is the driver reaction time, the time delay. And likewise, a critical element in forming the heat flux jam is a time delay between the between the heat flux and the temperature gradient, which is a consequence of the finite time for turbulent mixing. So these are, I think, a few of the things we've been playing with. I just should say in conclusion that there is another interesting topic of which, if you like King Kong meets Godzilla, you might call it of Alphane versus Kelvin. And it's a question of what happens if you put an in-plane magnetic field in one of these systems. And you then have a fight between PV conservation or conservation of circulation and also conservation of magnetic flux. And it turns out that the magnetic field control parameters can effectively feed back and control the flow. And even a modest amount of magnetic field can suppress the generation of zonal flows. And this is an interesting topic for systems like the solar tachocline, where there's a lot of concern about how momentum is transported there. And, you know, there's two schools of thought, Spiegel and Zond versus Goff and McIntyre, and we think they're both wrong, essentially. One says it's a cascade, one says it's an inverse cascade, and we would say it's effectively zero. From the fact that the competition of the two freezing in laws inhibits jet formation and momentum transport. So many things, I think, interesting things going on in the program. Thank you.
Because there is no generalized potential vorticity or generalized magnetic flux that would go, you're saying that if there was, there would be, you would expect zonal flows in, say, the sun or the solar tracker plane, but since there isn't such a generalized conserved quantity, that then means that there probably aren't? Is that what?
Well, I would say it's that they're not so simple. It becomes a quantitative question. I mean, well, briefly, you know, what happens if we go to beta plane MHD, right? So we'd have d by dt of del squared phi is beta dx phi, and then we would have a b dot grad j, right? As you know, which when you think of MHD. So in some sense, the flux of vorticity, or the flux of charge, I think is a better way to think of it. You can think of vorticity as polarization charge, has an electrostatic piece, as we had before, right? And this just becomes a Reynolds force for the zonal flow. But now there is a flow of current along tilted field lines, right, which comes out of this. The same game that I played with the Taylor identity here, I can play here, right? And these two, as the system becomes more alphanic, in other words, approaching more and more a kind of equalization of hydrodynamic and magnetic energy in the fluctuations, these things tend to oppose each other and cancel. And that acts to suppress the generation of the zonal mode. And what comes out in the story is if you make a plot of resistivity versus the input field, you know, up here you get zonal flows, down here you get zip. And this line is set by parameters. And it's interesting because it says is the resistivity by dissipating the field will allow the zonal flow to form. The magnetic field by C, even if this is really weak, but it can be stretched and amplified by the turbulence, it will inhibit the formation of the zonal flows. And the actual outcome then is a competition between the two things. So it's not an easy answer. It's not a yes, no. It's a quantitative question.
So much below this line in the zip region, it's not the picture you just, it's not the Hasegawa-Lima regime.
You have to bring in this thing, you have to add the, you have to break the conservation of PV. But it's a question, the right question is how much breaking is necessary, right? And that graph tells you how much breaking is necessary to have the requisite effect.
In your analogy with the avalanche models, in avalanche models, the spatial extent and the lifetime of an avalanche have funny, anomalous, quote unquote, scaling. Do you find analogies to that too?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. Many of you in our program had the pleasure of Guillaume's lecture on gyrokinetics, which is essentially a reduced description to eliminate the cyclotron motion, kind of taking the same ideas that you play in these geophysical fluids and going to kinetic theory. And so there is a big industry of gyrokinetic simulations, and several simulations have produced results that if I look at the spectrum of the flux, right, so I can look at kind of the spectrum of variations in the flux, you know, I'll get something, that I get the characteristic one upon omega sitting right there like you do in the avalanche. And I've got another view graph I can show you that if I change the axes between the pile and the rather monstrous simulation, the labels, you couldn't tell the difference. It's quite amazing.
The one over omega is sort of an averaged behavior of the avalanches. But if you look at individual avalanches, you make histograms of their, you get strange exponents. You don't get things like.
Of course, but I mean, of course, and you do get that behavior as well. It has not been extensively studied, but you do get these kind of intermittent distributions. And it's very interesting that it is, there is a whole range of avalanche sizes, of course, between the profile scale and the correlation scale of the fluctuations and which these things fill up. And this is very important, going back to the beginning, to this issue of confinement prediction, this problem of gyrobone breaking. As I say, the answer that people want, to build ETHER, spend $20 billion of your dollars, and I suspect many of you have other ideas on how to spend the money, is, you take bone diffusion and multiply it by the ratio of the gyro radius to the system size, right? And this is very good. You said build a bigger one, confinement will get better. Now, what actually happens is you don't quite get this. You get this to some power alpha, where alpha is close to but not quite one. And the reason for that deviation may be the avalanching. In other words, the system is producing intermittent and bursty things that then span larger than a single scale size. That's a critical question, actually.
Thank you.